these are the kinds of reasons why classical Democrats and libertarians were so hostile to corporate power. Now, they didn't really see it. They were on the classical period. I mean, people like Thomas Jefferson, they were only witnessing the very early incipient moments of what was going on, but enough to see it and not to like it. So Thomas Jefferson in 1816 expressed his fear that the country, I'm quoting him now, that the country was moving toward a single and splendid government of an aristocracy founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations. And if that tendency, which was just beginning, continued, he said, it would be the end of democracy and freedom. The few would be riding and ruling over the plundered plowman and the beggared yeomanry. Well, that was 1816. A decade later, period of Jacksonian democracy, Jefferson was a little more optimistic. Right before his death, in fact, I think hours before his death, he spoke at the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And in speaking there, he made a crucial distinction, which is worth paying careful attention to. He distinguished, I'll use his words, between those who fear and distrust the people and wish to draw all powers from them into the hands of the higher classes, that's one category, and the others are those who identify with the people, have confidence in them, cherish and consider them as the most honest and safe depository of the public interest, even though not the most wise. That's the second category of people. And he was hoping that the second category would be in the ascendancy. Well, looking now, that was 1826, it's clear, should be clear to any observer, that Thomas Jefferson's worst fears have been realized. Effective power is indeed in the hands of the higher classes. The early institutions of banking institutions and moneyed in corporations that he was concerned about are now vast in power and control and dominate the decision-making system, essentially in secret. And modern democratic theory, interestingly, is based on, has veered very sharply from Jeffersonian ideas, and in fact is precisely based on fear and distrust of the people, who must not be allowed to determine public policy or enter into the public arena because, as contemporary thinkers put it, they are too stupid and ignorant. They agree with Jefferson only on one point, that the people are perhaps not the most wise, but they disagree with him on everything else. And that's rather important. I'll return to that. Well, if we go back earlier, say half a century earlier, to Adam Smith, he was describing a world that is very different from ours, so much so that the descriptions and the explanations really don't carry over very well, but the ideas do. He lived too early to see the autocratic structures of modern industrial capitalism, and he didn't anticipate their development. But he was already, at that period, very much opposed to joint stock companies, what we nowadays call corporations. And he was particularly opposed to them if, as he feared might happen, they would become personified and made permanent. That is, they would gain the status of immortal persons, in effect, with all the rights of persons, except immortal. And that, in fact, is exactly what happened in the 19th century. If you look at one of the major parts of American 19th century history is the creation of corporate power by government decision and the turning corporations, which used to be sort of public interest groups, like build a bridge or something, into immortal persons with the rights of persons, which if you have corporate power means vast rights well beyond any real person. That didn't happen through the democratic process. Actually, it happened primarily through judicial decision, decision by lawyers and judges and so on, as part of the effort to create a developmental state, a powerful interventionist state that would introduce a high level of protectionism and direct public resources to private power, and in that way enable development to take place. Incidentally, that's the only way in history that development has ever taken place from England up to South Korea and Taiwan, and there's some lessons there too. The prescriptions that contemporary economic ideologues, whatever you want to call them, offer to underdeveloped societies have the interesting property that they are refuted 100% of the time. If you can find one case in history of a society that's developed by those rules or even marginally using them. It'd be interesting to hear about it. Nobody's come up with one yet. There are cases of societies that have followed those rules, and they're mostly basket cases. Again, something worth looking at when you read primers on free trade and so on the front pages of the New York Times. Well, again, that's that other topic I'm not talking about. The judiciary in the 19th century did create the permanent, the immortal persons that Adam Smith was so concerned about. And again, his worst fears were realized. Adam Smith, though, again, it's a very different world that he was describing, and the arguments don't, you could argue about whether they went through for his world, but they don't go through for ours. Nevertheless, the ideas are interesting, and the beliefs, and worth paying attention to. This is part of the system of classical liberal thought, the basis for, you know, modern libertarian theories of freedom and democracy. He held that markets could function properly only under conditions of relative equality. And he also thought and gave a long argument to try to show that liberty would lead to equality, either to absolute perfect liberty would lead either to absolute equality or to continual tendencies toward equality. And insofar as we don't attain that state of equality or near equality, insofar as that's not realized, that simply indicates that we've not attained the state of liberty, of perfect liberty. Well, of course, the discrepancies are vast and growing, and that gives you a measure of how far we are from liberty in any sense that someone like Adam Smith would have recognized. He held, in fact, that only under conditions of relative equality and tendencies toward equality would market competition be efficient or fair, and thus able to contribute to its further ends. The market was no end in itself for people like Adam Smith. The further ends were realization of human capacities and potentialities. And a market could contribute to those ends insofar as it was relatively equal, as the outcomes were relatively equal, and that he thought would happen under conditions of liberty. Otherwise, you don't have liberty. The very foundation of liberty in Adam Smith's view, and this is standard Enlightenment thinking, is the right of every workman to the fruits of his own labor. That, he said, is sacred and inviolable. It's a crucial element in self-fulfillment, as another major classical liberal thinker, Wilhelm von Humboldt, who's very much inspired John Stuart Mill, as he put it, if a craftsman creates something beautiful, but does it on external command by the orders of someone else and under coercion, we may admire what he does, but we will despise what he is. Because he's not human, he's a machine. Adam Smith held the same view. Coming to the present, John Dewey, who again was one of the increasingly lone voices speaking for democracy and freedom in the 20th century, 20th century America, though he was very much, surely, in the mainstream intellectual and political culture of his day, that's the first half of the 20th century, increasingly marginalized. By now his views are almost unrecognizable. He held, let me just read them, and I'm reading it because I think it's basically correct, incidentally. His views, and it should be a vision for the future, as it was a vision of the great libertarians of the past. He held that politics is the shadow in our society, politics is the shadow cast on society by big business. And as long as that is so, the attenuation of the shadow will not change the substance. In other words, reforms are basically pointless. The reason is that a democracy requires that the shadow of big business simply be removed so that the political system can function. The very institutions of private power, he stressed, undermine freedom and democracy. And he was very explicit about the anti-democratic power that he was talking about, quote Dewey. It resides in control of the means of production, exchange, publicity, transportation, and communication. Whoever owns them rules the life of the country, even if under democratic forms, you know, acting within the shadow that big business casts. Business for private profit through private control of banking, land, industry, reinforced by command of the press, press agents, and other means of publicity and propaganda. That, he said, is the system of actual power, the source of coercion. And unless it's unraveled, we cannot seriously talk about democracy or freedom. Continuing in a free or a democratic society, workers have to be masters of their own industrial fate. That's a classical liberal doctrine. Find it right through classical liberalism. Adam Smith, Humboldt, and the rest. Thomas Jefferson, of course. It is illiberal and immoral, Dewey said, to train children to work for the sake of the wage earned, not freely and intelligently, under their own control. Hence, industry must be changed, if democracy is to exist, it must be changed from a feudalistic to a democratic social order. All of these are, or at least should be, truisms. And indeed, they were very common coin. They were common ideas among working people, uneducated working people, not all that long ago, turn of the century, for example, when working people called for an end to what was standardly called wage slavery, which they regarded as not very different from chattel slavery.